What is the perfect story? Does it exist? Is there a tangible formula? Has the perfect story ever been told? And if so, are we simply trying to retell this story over and over? This podcast is called The Midnight Myth, and somewhere between the black of night and the break of dawn, there is a story, and it's perfect. My name is Derek Jones.
And my name is Laurel Hostack.
Welcome to The Midnight Myth. Welcome back to The Midnight Myth, everybody's favorite history, mythology, philosophy, and how those subjects bubble up into our popular storytelling podcast. As always, I am very, very, very excited to be back with some Midnight Myth content. It's been a minute since we've done a proper Midnight Myth episode.
It sure has, and it feels really, really, really good to be behind the mic with you again, Derek.
I'm glad you feel that way. I truly am. I am feeling exhausted and my tank is on empty, if I'm being honest.
Oh, yeah, same. But yeah, there is just a special energy between us, I think, and I hope that it sparks you back awake and dynamically so.
There's a saying I tell my team at work, and it has never really steered me wrong. Fake it till you make it, baby.
Oh, yes.
And we are back. One thing I just want to kind of clear the air. The last actual Midnight Myth episode was a month ago, and it wasn't a traditional Midnight Myth. It was a meditation, and we were lucky enough to have our friend Jeff guest on it, which was great. We want to be doing more regular Midnight Myth, but there is a bit of a logistical hurdle in that we have a two-year-old. And we don't just have a two-year-old. We have a Tasmanian devil of a two-year-old.
We have Hurricane Arthur.
And it's really, really hard to fit podcasting in with what Laurel and I do. One, our episodes require a lot of research. Two, we typically tend to talk about movies, and we have about an hour, maybe an hour and a half tops between Arthur going to sleep and us going to sleep.
Right.
And movies these days are all over 2.5 hours long. So there's not a lot of space for us to engage in new movies right now. So we are well far behind on all of the movies that have been out this year, all of the movies that have been out in the last 2 or 3 years, to be perfectly honest. So we're trying to figure out ways we can fit the podcast in. We haven't mastered it yet. But one thing that we did, I want to say it was this year, but time's a flat circle. It might have been last year, is we did a bunch of episodes around Tim Burton. And that was really easy for us to get into. We had a lot of nostalgia about it. And then we went back and we realized we'd been kind of unintentionally grouping Midnight Myth episodes by film auteur directors. And we thought that was a good way to try to get the Midnight Myth juices going, to come up with a project that we can say, hey, we're doing this on the Midnight Myth right now. And that is what led us to this new episode and the next two episodes, which will be dissecting and discussing the film works of Wes Anderson. So I hope you like symmetry. I hope you like characters that are a little snooty and a little pretentious, because we're going to spend this episode of the next two talking about Wes Anderson. You know, and another reason it's hard to get the Midnight Myth is I've been doing the Wheel of Kaa with Steve. Laurel has been knocking it out of the park with Sleep and Sorcery. And those podcasts don't require both of us. And with our two-year-old, it makes it a lot easier to schedule, because one of us can watch the kid while the other one of us can record a podcast. But we have no intention on stopping the Midnight Myth. We want to keep going. It's just going to be a little irregular. So that being said, we're going to kick off tonight our conversation about Wes Anderson, and we're going to start with the Royal Tenenbaums.
Awesome. I'm so glad that we're here. Thank you, listeners, for sticking with us, even though things have been a little bit irregular. We are committed to this. We have to just kind of soldier on through early parenting. Anyway, we're super glad you're here. Along with hoping that you like, you know, sort of twee characters and hoping that you like symmetry, I hope you like epic needle drops, and I hope you like tons of melanges of references, because holy cow, Wes Anderson is full of them. And yeah, like you said, Derek, we're starting off with the film that really put this man on the map. If Rushmore, his second feature, didn't do it, this was the one that broke him into the stratosphere of indie directors and has put him on an auteur level with his contemporaries in the indie sphere, like Paul Thomas Anderson and even, dare I say it, Quentin Tarantino. He is a voice that is as recognizable as those and will probably be as prolific and as remembered and as heavily critiqued as those. So I'm very excited to dive into some of his works, and particularly excited to kick it off with The Royal Tenenbaums, my introduction to him.
And just a quick question for you, for people listening, because our audience is very eclectic with different interests, people from different backgrounds, different intellectual habits. What would or how would you define a film auteur?
Me?
Yeah, you went to film school.
Sure. So I would say I would define it as a film director slash writer, filmmaker as the like large definition for this person who imposes a significantly unique and characteristic style upon their films, has something to say that is somehow thematically woven through many, if not all, of the films in their oeuvre, and who, when you look at their films, you know it's them. I think that really is how I would sort of colloquially define it. There are certainly essays and essays and essays on essays about this, but really it's about someone who has a vision and who claims from sort of start to finish the ownership of the filmmaking process. So as we know, a film is something that usually takes dozens to hundreds of people to make, but when it is a singular vision coming to fruition from one person that is served by all of the fabulous collaborators that they have, that's when we start to put them in the auteur category.
Yeah, I love that definition. And I always kind of think of it, I didn't really know the term until I met you, because you went to film school. And I knew a lot of people in various, you know, disciplines and various artistries and various intellectual pursuits and habits, but I'd never really got into like the film and theater scene, which you introduced me to. I always thought it of someone, when I watch the movie, I know who directed it.
Yeah.
It's easy, like just by, like if no one tells me it's a Wes Anderson movie and I sit down and it just comes on and I'm looking at it and I think to myself, that's got to be Wes Anderson. I think you also need to know their name.
Yeah.
Right. If you don't know the director's name and know who they are and are attracted to that director, you really can't be an auteur. But if I know their name, I know their style, and I can easily identify it. Derek Jones, who never studied film or went to film school, when I sit down and see a Stanley Kubrick movie, right, I know it's a Stanley Kubrick movie. Conversely, when you see a James Cameron movie, is he an auteur? Well, you know, there's a lot of movies that James Cameron has done, but they don't all scream Cameron, other than maybe breakthrough special effects. Or Steven Spielberg, another one, because Steven Spielberg, I greatly admire as a storyteller, as a blockbuster Hollywood storyteller, but I don't necessarily get a particular singular style throughout all of his movies. All of his movies are saying very different things. E.T. is radically different from Saving Private Ryan and radically different from
Schindler's List.
Schindler's List, yeah. So, and not saying Steve, this is not to say Stephen Spielberg, pardon me, isn't amazing. I warned you all I was tired. But I don't consider him an auteur in the way I consider Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson, to me, is very, of the auteurs of our generation, he is the auteuriest of them.
Nice, yeah. And it's a term that's French for author, right? So it suggests that you are the singular author of the piece, even though it is a collaborative venture. And that's not to diminish the contributions of the collaborators, but it is to say that you drive this vision and it is unique to you.
And the fact that Americans and English are saying a French word when we have an English word for it kind of gives it an air of pretension. An auteur is pretentious. And of the auteurs, is there anyone more pretentious than Wes Anderson?
So I'm glad that you asked that question. And before we kind of jump into the movie, I just want to address that because I feel like it is the elephant in the room with him. And I would actually push back on Wes Anderson as pretentious. I think, especially when you hear him talk about his movies, he talks about them with such a sort of down-to-earth manner that I don't think Wes Anderson is pretentious. I think his characters are. And I think more often than not, he is making fun of their pretension while also using that as an anchor and an engine to drive this deep pathos within even the most insufferable characters. And we see that within Royal Tenenbaums and within many of his films. So I am someone who like fell out of love with Wes Anderson in the 2010s and have come back around to recognizing that I think there is deep, genuine pathos, tenderness, and really palpable theme that drives almost all of his movies. So I push back on the pretension, but I also merit it.
Well, when I said it, I didn't mean him as a human being.
Yeah.
I've never met him. I don't know him. I meant his work. His work has a certain pretension to it. And whether it's the characters are pretentious and that's meant to be ironic or not, I think there is an air to it, but that's something that maybe we'll circle back at the end of this and we'll have that discussion again. And maybe we'll feel differently. For as much as I admire and like so many of Wes Anderson's movies, he's not a director that I will go and watch over and over and over again. Like, I have seen so many movies, my favorite movies, I've seen at least 6 times, many of them into the hundreds. I've seen every Wes Anderson movie I've seen once, maybe twice. You know, and I think that's an interesting thing to meditate on as we get into this. But we put the cart well before the horse because I came out with a old school style Midnight Myth boomerang where I'm like, let me just ask Laurel a question we hadn't prepared. Let us actually start this episode. Laurel, do your thing.
Oh, yeah. I'll keep my thing short. We just want to hear from you. We're on Twitter. We're at The Midnight Myth on Twitter. We're on Facebook and we're on Instagram at Midnight Myth Podcast. And we're also on the World Wide Web at midnightmyth.com. So drop us a line. Also, if you like what you hear, leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. It really helps us get out there. Also, on our feed, recently published, and now on its own individual feed, check out The Wheel of Ka if you are a Stephen King fan or if you are looking to get into Stephen King and want a companion to help you read and understand what you're reading. Check it out. Derek and Steve are doing amazing work, and they just get better and better and better. They just read my favorite Stephen King book, 11/22/63, and it was their best episode yet. So big shout out to Wheel of Ka. Also check out my other podcast, Sleep and Sorcery, which is available on podcast players, on YouTube, and on Insight Timer. And that is a sleep podcast to put you to sleep to the sounds of fantasy, folklore, and fairy tales. So definitely check out our other shows while you wait for more sweet, sweet Midnight Myth content.
And fellow travelers on the path of the beam with Wheel of Ka, Steve and I have just started reading the Stephen King and Peter Straub combination, The Talisman. We're really at the very beginning. I think we're both like 80 pages in. So if you want to read along with us and listen to our episodes, really good time to pick up a copy of The Talisman. Maybe you've never read it before. Maybe you want to read it. Maybe you have read it and you want to reread it, but that should be out. We're not exactly sure when we're going to do the next episode. We're going to find a place where we feel like we should stop and talk, and that's where we're stop and talk. It probably won't be at the end of the book. because it's a very big book.
Yeah, well, follow us on Twitter and follow at Wheel of Ka as well, because you can see updates and see their reading journey and when they think they're going to record.
Briefest of brief recaps coming right at you. This is a movie about a family called the Tenenbaums, led by the patriarch Royal Tenenbaum. It's about him, his wife, and their three children, all of whom are geniuses of various varieties and types. As it turns out, Royal is a terrible father, and he ends up estranged from his family, and all of his children go on to, in their early years, having outrageous success. Chaz being successful in business, Margot being successful as a playwright, and Richie being successful in tennis. And all of them, as they mature into their, you know, beginning to transition out of youth and young adult into middle age, all have meltdowns in which they start to break down. Chaz loses his wife in an accident, and his neuroses and his anxiety has him training his sons in disaster relief, and deems his home unsafe and moves back to the family home in New York. At the same time, Margot decides that she is depressed and that she is no longer a playwright. She leaves her husband and moves back home. Whereas Richie is in love with his adopted sister, Margot. When he learns that she is married, has a meltdown on the tennis court and ends up going back to the home. Conversely, Royal, now flat broke, who had been living in a hotel for a long period of time, has decided to trick his family into thinking that he's dying in the hopes that he can move back in. And also under the idea that, hey, I'm dying, I might as well try to use this excuse to spend some time with my family. He spends 6 days back in the house until his wife's new boyfriend, soon-to-be husband, uncovers that Royal, in fact, is not dying, and it's a big ruse. And in this moment, Royal realizes those 6 days with his family were the happiest of his life. He then decides to earnestly and genuinely try to repair the damage with his family. There is another character who's a best friend of Richie's named Eli, who has a drug problem that is made worse by his fame as a now successful college professor and novelist. He is also sleeping with Margot. And all of this culminates at the wedding of Royal's wife, played by Angelica Houston, whose name is, Laurel, help me out.
Etheline.
I can never remember that name. And with Royal making earnest attempts at amends, is now welcomed into the wedding. And Eli comes and crashes his car and almost kills Chaz's kids, but does sadly kill Chaz's puppy. And in the end, this tragedy realizes that everyone in this is messed up and they all need help, and their family starts to heal. Sadly, Royal does die shortly thereafter of a heart attack, but he has finally made amends with his son, Chaz, who is the most angry at him for being a bad father. Oh, I don't know. I don't want to rank it. Margot's pretty mad too. And there you have it. The family ends up healing. Royal ends up dying, and that they get to go on and live their lives. That is the briefest of brief recaps. Movie came out in 2001. Here we are, 2023. Does it hold up? Is it worth talking about? I hadn't seen this movie in a decade, easily, maybe longer. What are your high-level thoughts, Laurel?
Well, first of all, I want to point out that your briefest of recaps was amazing, but you did not talk about Richie's suicide attempt.
Completely forgot. Richie tries to kill himself, realizing that Margot not only is married, but is also very promiscuous and cheats on her husband, and the pain of her having so many lovers. He does try to kill himself. And that's sort of like one of the emotional mountaintops by which he gets over the suicide. He admits to Margot that he loves her. She admits that she loves him back. And by that, they're able to heal. And in it, Royal's just like, well, you know, you're adopted. It's probably illegal, but what the hell?
Yeah. Awesome. So you asked me about my high-level thoughts. Does it hold up? I want to say, you know, you mentioned earlier that you don't rewatch a lot of Wes Anderson's movies. And for me, that's not the case. This movie in particular, I've probably seen upwards of 10 times. And this, however, was the first time I had seen it as an adult. This is something that came out when I was an adolescent. I was, you know, like 11 years old when this came out, and my family watched it a ton. It was just something that was always on in our house when I was living there before I went to college. So it's something that I saw so many times that I practically have like half the movie memorized. And yet watching it as an adult was just an extremely emotional experience. It was a very different experience because there's so much that I just couldn't quite comprehend in terms of like subtle relationship building and emotions and roles that these characters had that just was not available to me as a youth and that really, really hit home as a grown-up. I do think the movie 99% holds up. I think Royal's casual racism doesn't necessarily hold up, but almost everything else about it does. I think it's a masterpiece. I think it is pretty close to a perfect movie, and that is because every single detail of this film in Wes's peak style, it's reaching kind of its heightened clarity as far as like his style being in service of theme and character. That plus the music, the cinematography, the color, the pastiche fantasy New York that we step into, that's almost like a New Yorker magazine meets a French New Wave film. All of these strange, neurotic characters who are also deeply real and deeply authentic with these extraordinary performances by a mega powerhouse ensemble cast. Like, it's really hard to beat all the things that went right in this movie. And all of the trust that was put in this pretty new director who only had two small indie features under his belt and really just threw everything at this one. I love it. I think watching it as an adult who has her own neuroses and as a parent who is trying to comprehend like how much we screw up our kids and how much there is to lose in a family, it was just really deeply affecting instead of just being awkwardly funny like it was to me as a kid. And I think also the balance of humor and pathos is really outstanding. So that's a lot of gushing. I'll have a lot more to say as we go on, but I really do think it holds up extremely well.
I want to push back on one thing that I disagree with that you said, that Royal's casual racism doesn't hold up. I flat out disagree with that.
Really?
I do, because I feel that that is very true to this character. This character that exists, this mega rich lawyer who produces these junior genius kids, who is at truth just a scumbag criminal, would absolutely be casually racist. And, you know, I don't think this, if this movie were saying casual racism is okay, then it wouldn't hold up, because casual racism is not okay. But in fact, I think it's saying, look at how despicable this man is and his casual racism, and as another piece of evidence of what a bad guy Royal is, to highlight the change when he finally ends up realizing, wow, the only thing that has ever made me happy in my life was pretending to be nice to my family. What if I try to be nice to my family? Could that also make me happy? And he even goes to that character and says, I misjudged you. And he blesses their marriage. And he is there at their wedding. So I think even the character that he's casually racist to, which is Etheline's suitor, the accountant, Henry.
Yeah.
He forgives him. That character forgives him for it, because I think there is a true mea culpa there. So from my perspective, I don't think that ages poorly at all. You know, I don't think that does, you know, I think this movie is saying, and this movie's not engaged with deep conversations about race, but in the respect that it is, it is clearly saying that this man's casual racism is wrong because this character comes out and says, I was wrong about it. And I think in that respect, I don't think that ages poorly. That's my opinion on it.
I think that's fair. You know, I if it was made today, you know, that scene wouldn't be in there is all I'm really saying. And like there would be a harsher, like direct indictment of a character speaking the really kind of awful things that he speaks to Henry. And also, like, I don't think boys should be dogfighting, and I don't think dogfighting is funny. But, like, you know, I can look past a lot of those things, but it's just something that makes me cringe today.
Yeah, I get it. I also I feel very similar about the dogfighting, too. That I don't think this movie is saying you should allow dogfighting to happen. I think dogfighting is another example of the gruesome and grotesque levels by which Royal is willing to go, that he enjoys watching dogs rip each other apart, and the extent to which his family wishes that he actually would pay attention to him, that he takes only one of his children there, then he takes his grandchildren there. It's another example of his deep-rooted misogyny that exists in this character, that he does, like, he does value his two boys more than his one girl. And he does value of his two boys. He clearly has a favorite and doesn't like the other two. Like, he straight up betrays Chaz in their childhood game of BBs and permanently embeds a BB in his skin. So it's another example of his misogyny. You know, I don't think it's saying it's okay to take your kids to dogfighting, in which case, yes, that wouldn't age well. But no one in 2000 thought dogfighting was okay. There wasn't this big pro dog fighting in particular in 2000 of people going to Wes Anderson movies. We're not like the pro dog fighting community.
The Venn diagram of like Wes Anderson fans and dog fighters. Like, imagine you
literary students, you know, in 2000 going to see Wes Anderson aren't the same people that were going to dog fights then. You know?
Yeah, no, you make a good argument. I'm just saying those are things that today I'm like, but
I think you touch on something, though. We current moviegoers want the politics of the movies to reflect the politics of our heart. And sometimes the politics of the characters don't. And that's okay. You know, because it's not a propaganda film, you know, like, I think
this is as close to like an apolitical film as you can get. Like, exactly. It's really very, it feels so contained in its own little universe that these things almost don't exist. And so that's why they feel almost like an intrusion to me. I don't want to spend the whole episode on this, but like, that's just, yeah, I get it. I get what you're saying.
My point is that this movie is clearly creating a fantasy world.
Yeah.
It's clearly not meant to exist in our world. It doesn't have the same rules as our world. And we don't necessarily need 2023 politics entering into a 2000 fantasy New York. I think is, in my opinion, a difficult read and more of a square peg in a round hole read. You're saying, oh, well, you know, this, it's like, well, no, that's not what this movie's about, which to me is a great way to transition into asking in the analysis piece, what is this movie about?
Well, we all know that Custer died at Little Bighorn, but what this movie presupposes is maybe he didn't.
Maybe he didn't.
Anyway, I think that's a great question. What do you think this movie's about, Derek?
Oh, you're passing it to me.
I took it and I spun it and I did a little movie quote and then I threw it back at you.
There is so much history, mythology, and philosophy in this movie. It's kind of hard from the Midnight Myth treatment lens to know where to begin. I think the most immediate read is that this movie is about masculinity and it is engaging in masculine archetypes and it's engaging in what does it mean to be a man, a powerful man? What does it mean to be a woman married to a powerful man? What does it mean to be an adopted daughter surrounded by these powerful men. And I think it's because the movie is oriented around Royal as our main character, who is a toxic masculine man. I think that one of the things this movie successfully does within the Wes Anderson style, the pastels, the symmetry, is that he situates this almost magical, beautiful, symmetrical universe right smack dab into more regular, mundane New York. I feel like this movie exists in both a magical and mundane world simultaneously. There are ugly beat-up cabs right next to genius philosophers, artists, and business professionals. And that magical and mundane happening simultaneously really makes me think about ancient paganism, that supposed that the ancient gods and the ancient spirits and the ancient et ceteras, they lived on Earth. They were part of this world. They were part of the non-magical or the mundane world, and then the divine or the magical world existed at the same time. To go with Greek mythology, Mount Olympus is a real place that you could travel and go to. Hell is a real place that you could go, or the underworld that you could go and travel to. You could physically go there, but when you die, that's also where you go. So all of these things are very literal and real and living right alongside where average people lived. If we think about the deconstruction and questions around masculinity and understand this as a movie where the magical and mundane, the mythological and the regular are living side by side, I have a particular read on this movie. I don't necessarily want to say it's correct. I think it's very subjective, but I have a particular read on this movie and an interpretation that, and I want to stay in Greek myth, this mythological read to it, because I feel like it's the one that makes the most sense, but I think there could be others. That let us understand that where did Western masculine archetypes originally derive from? Where are they rooted in our historical, philosophical, political, mythological, religious discourses? They come from Zeus. And Zeus is the figure of ancient Greece who then goes on to kind of mold into Jupiter, and then the actual statue of Jupiter is the basis for the artistic rendering of Jesus that we still know today. So this figure looms large here. And what if we could understand royal as Zeus? What is Zeus very famous for among, you know, killing the Titans, forming Olympus, you know, having the thunderbolt? But when he starts interacting with mortals, what does he do? He comes down and he sires children. These children become demigods, and after siring these children, what does he do? He bounces back to Olympus. He's a neglectful, toxically masculine male who spreads his seed to as many beautiful women as he wants, whenever he wants, without regard to the consequences. And then when his semi-divine, semi-human children need him, where is he? He's off in Olympus tinkering with the other gods. He's a deadbeat dad. Very powerful, very well known, but a deadbeat dad. What if the deconstruction that we're seeing of royal as toxically masculine is also the deconstruction of Zeus? Royal is Zeus. Royal is a bad dad. Let's take this metaphor a little further. Three of his children end up becoming demigods in this metaphor. They are part Zeus, but part human. So what do? They live with their mothers, they are raised on Earth, and they are given dominion over something. So the ancient demigod would go out, commit great heroic acts that would help shape and form society, and then they would return kings of this area, and they would rule. For example, Heracles goes on to form the people who would become Spartan. Who is Heracles' father? Zeus. Perseus, another very famous son of Zeus, forms Mycenae. Mycenae is the ancient civilization by which all ancient Greece claimed to be coming from. It's the Mycenaean Greeks that waged the Trojan War in Greek history or in Greek mythology / pseudo history. No one really knows because it's that long ago. So the idea is, if you're in an ancient Greece and you want to rule over an area, you better claim lineage to some of these demigods, because the demigods is what gives you dominion. So royal, he has a wife, he sires three children. All three are exceptional from a very young age. Another thing that the Greek demigod hero must be exceptional early on, and everyone sees the exceptionality early on. And then when they grow up, they go on quests and they hold dominion. Chaz, his quest is to conquer business. And by the time he's a young adult, he is not only a super successful businessman, he does what every Greek god hates. He usurps his father in the area of business. Margot becomes a successful playwright, and then she goes on to travel the world and is completely phenomenal in literature and theater, etc. You know, you get my drift here. Richie, top, tennis star. So athletics, arts, and business, they have their dominions by which they rule. And in most Greek myths, that's where the stories end. The demigod holds dominion and things end. Well, Wes Anderson is, in my opinion, I don't know if this is intentional or not, this is just a read, is asking the question, what happens next? What happens after that? What does it really mean to be incredibly talented and gifted and have a deadbeat dad? What does it mean to have all of this success and wealth and prestige and fame, but you've never felt loved? What would that look like if your father never loved you and you were amazing at something? And all three of these children are incredibly broken. And traditional Zeus-like fashion, when things aren't going well for Zeus, what does Royal want to do? I'll do everything in my power to make things better for me. Why? Because I'm Zeus. And when that fails, and he is confronted with the results of his inadequacies as a father, in his failure to reconcile his toxic godhood or masculinity, maybe those are interchangeable in this metaphor, what does he do? He genuinely tries to amend. What happens when Zeus learns he's wrong? What happens when the demigod is at peace? Where would the story go next? And I feel like the Royal Tenenbaums is about those fundamental questions. And in that, it's upending the very nature and very conception of what it means to be a powerful, great Western god, demigod, man. Because if the Western man is based off of the Western gods, first and foremost, then the Western man seeks to be like the Western gods. And Royal is showing us what went wrong. I think there's so many amazing moments in this movie that blends comedy and tragedy so nimbly. And I think it bounces back. And the way it bounces back from the magical and mundane, to me, it balances those things so nimbly, where Royal, very understated, just goes to Chaz and says, take it easy on those kids. You don't want this to happen to you. And like most of these ancient Greek stories I'm basing this metaphor off of, they all make the same mistake over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And a cycle perpetuates. It's never ending. It's written in stone. Men are gonna suck, have lots of kids. They're gonna grow up to be jerks, and they're gonna try to kill each other. And that's the way it is. And here we have Royal saying, I got to break this cycle. I only have a limited amount of time that I might have any kind of positive impact on these people, and I must break the cycle.
Yeah, what would happen if the figure that taught you as an individual or you as a culture how to be a man told you maybe that's not actually the way to be a man? and came to you and atoned and tried to heal those wounds. I think that's an excellent read. I want to respond to a few of the things that you put out there. One of those being kind of the what happened next question, because I also sort of look at this as like the first 10 minutes, which are this Alec Baldwin narrated storybook prologue and the story of the adolescence of the Tenenbaum children and the failed marriage between Royal and Etheline. It's a Greek tragedy in 10 minutes. And then the movie is what's next. The Greek tragedy is the prologue. The rise and fall of this prominent man and his prominent family are just the given circumstances. In most other movies, that would be the story. The story is about what's next, how these broken people put the pieces back together, and how both the downfall and the reigniting of a family connection is spurred by this really loser of a man who comes to be the great man that he is supposed to be, that he purports to be, I would argue, by the end of the movie.
And I would say, I love that point. I think the movie has a ton of Egyptian mythological-ness to it. So it's like weird saying, I think this is about the Greek rather than the Egyptian. One, there's a scene in which there's a stack of books on Egypt mythology. Etheline is an archaeologist and is unearthing a skeleton the way an archaeologist would unearth, a Egyptologist, pardon me, would unearth a mummy. You know, there's there's definitely themes of resurrection in which you have that are heavy in Egyptian mythology. So I think the easiest one-on-one is Egyptian mythology. Egyptian mythology is also highly patriarchal. It is highly about the role of the king being all-knowing, all-powerful, a god on earth and a god in heaven when they die. And so I think Egypt mythology is there too. But when I just watched it, personal interpretation, I felt the spirit of the Greek myths and the Greek heroes. I felt them singing out of the characters.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
You know, even though the movie is telling me this is about Egyptian mythology.
Well, and I don't think it's about any mythology, right? I think it's suffused with all of these layers of influences that are living in the archetypes, right? Because it is concerned with archetypes, and yet it is, in that very Wes way, taking these stock characters and really filling them out with genuine emotion and genuine pain and background and trauma and struggle. And all of that is concerned with what it's like to be a friggin' human. So our myths hum through that on little strings, right?
And I love that.
The other thing I wanted to respond to that you said was you started this off by saying this movie's about masculinity. And I was reflecting on this too when it comes to Wes Anderson, because you wouldn't naturally think when you look at his movies that this is a filmmaker who makes movies about masculine things because they're so pretty, right? Because they're so pink and because they're little jewel boxes and dollhouses and they're so precious. And yet, if you really look at the content of most of his movies and this one as an anchor to it, Rushmore, Darjeeling Limited, like it's all over his movies, they're primarily concerned with relationships between men and primarily adversarial relationships between men and the tough character work that has to happen to resolve those adversarial relationships between men. And often they are working in an interplay of the hardness and softness that is available in the masculine energy, and that both of those things are essential parts of the masculine energy. You look at a character like Richie, in particular, who is one of the most outwardly sensitive characters, but who's also the like consummate athlete. And that is seemingly so incongruous, but it lives so harmoniously within Richie and is like perfectly embodied in Luke Wilson. Eli, too, is affecting this kind of like Cormac McCarthy, like Old West novelist, great American writer masculinity, but he's also this like pretentious English professor who's also a scared little kid who never got approval from his family. There is so much of that hardness and softness that lives in the men that also, I think, really echoes with what you're talking about in terms of ancient Greek masculinity, because the standards were about being beautiful bodied, athletically gifted, and also great philosophers, right? Great thinkers and poets. And that feels like that lives within a Wes Anderson kind of lens.
I love that, because that is very true. In particular, when we think of the ancient Athenian or the ancient Spartan, and you were out of their education system, you would spend, you know, half of your day just exercising, and then the other half of the day learning all knowledge that you could: rhetoric, music, poetry, mathematics, philosophy. So you were expected to be both beautiful and educated and smart, and there was no area where they would tolerate any imperfection. Just a few things about the Egyptian side, just to bring up some other, just little tidbits I picked out. Richie's, where does he sleep in this? In a tent. What is it? It looks like a golden pyramid. The pyramids were once lined with gold. The symmetricalness of the shots mirrors the symmetrical architecture and design that you see in ancient Egypt. Everything in Egypt is very orderly. Everything has its place in its architecture, in its mythology, in its way of life. So you feel that as well. And characters are constantly put in small places that feel like they could be tombs, filled with stuff, lots and lots of stuff.
Like the game closet.
Yes. And the ancient Egyptians believed you could take your stuff with you to the afterlife, which is why they built these elaborate tombs, so they could put all their stuff in there and hopefully that it wouldn't get robbed, because they thought they could come back and get it if they needed it. So there's a lot of both of, I think there's a lot of this, but I don't feel a lot of the spirit of ancient myth or ancient Egyptian myth in it, other than, you know, resurrection and cycles. But like, it's about smashing those cycles, you know, like it really truly is. And I felt the Greek myth coming from me. Anyway, what do you think this movie's about?
Yeah, I just want to add quickly, you know, he's also, Royal Tenenbaum is also kind of Odin, right? He is a patriarch, he's an all-father, and yet he's also a little bit of a trickster and a wanderer with all of these crazy stories from his wanderings and travels. And so I just wanted to call that out too.
And Odin, the name Odin is believed to be the Germanic version, the word Odin, traced back to from Norse language to German, is suspected to be linked to Mercury.
Right.
Which is the Roman god who is based off of the, linked to the Greek god of
Hermes,
who is a trickster.
Speaking of Roman mythology, did you ever think, Derek, that you would see a day where I would be like, I'm going to talk about ancient Rome on the podcast?
I would hope so. So, I mean, you would bring up Rome. I mean, that'd be great.
Yeah. So
nothing makes me happier to be the person that's not linking something to Rome.
Anyway, so I wanted to take this in actually a kind of similar direction, although I think there's just a little bit of a distinction here with where I'm going with this. But I was inspired to really look into what a genius is, because we are told at the beginning of this movie that these children are geniuses. Etheline Tenenbaum writes a book called Family of Geniuses about her three children, and they go to press conferences, and everyone's impressed with their artistic, intellectual, and athletic talent. What kind of geniuses do we have? We have child prodigies, we have a business savant, we have a tortured artist, and we have a sensitive athlete. Like you said, they are kind of the gods of these little domains. But what is genius? When you hear the word, you're going to think, you know, it's popularly assigned to an extraordinary level of intelligence or creative talent. There's no scientific definition or measurement for genius quantitatively, but you and I can list off, you know, dozens of people who are genuinely and generally accepted to be geniuses, right? William Shakespeare, Madame Curie, Albert Einstein.
I was going to say Einstein.
Yeah.
Plato,
sure. These names just roll off the tongue, and everyone kind of knows that's a genius. Some of them are great thinkers. Some of them are great inventors. Some of them are great artists. But we all know a genius when we see them. Now, there's also, historically speaking, a recognized level of overlap when it comes to people who are regarded as geniuses and people with mental health disorders. When we think of Ernest Hemingway and Kurt Cobain and Vincent van Gogh, these are all people who have been labeled as geniuses, whose work is exalted the world over, but these are people who died by suicide because they were tormented. And there have been studies done to examine whether there is a genuine correlation between creative talent and mental illness, but those instances are so well known and so embedded in the popular consciousness that they've become a really almost tired cultural touchstone, right? Or cultural stereotype. But what do we have in the Tenenbaums, in this family of geniuses as they're labeled? We have three archetypes of the wounded genius. We have Chaz, who is the genius of business, who experiences post-traumatic stress and high levels of anxiety after the death of his wife. We have the tortured artist in Margot, who struggles with depression. And we have Richie, who is a great athlete and who attempts suicide by the end of the movie in a really shocking and violent scene that feels almost outside of this fairy tale world we're presented to. But by the time we meet these characters, we understand that they used to be geniuses, that this is them at the end of their genius, or this is them after they have melted down. They were so successful in childhood that now that they're grown up and they have adult problems to worry about, they feel like failures and they don't create, they don't make anymore. This is also a phenomenon that's been studied, the child prodigy who falls behind as they get older. Some scientists and psychologists who study this think that child prodigies maybe don't associate outcomes with effort, so they fall behind because they don't put in the effort. Everything comes so easily to them when they're young that they just don't try and they think things are just going to come to them.
I mean, fascinating, but I'm just wondering, you said you were going to talk about Rome here.
So all that said, I want to revisit the original definition of the term genius, because I think in addition to the accepted term that we have today, the original, the origin of it has a lot of application here that might not be obvious at first. So the word comes to us from ancient Rome, and it refers to tutelary deities. A genius is like a spirit associated with a certain place or with a family. It's closely related to two Latin terms that both signify in some way creation, procreation, generating, begetting, giving birth. It has something to do with bringing forth something, and usually procreation. So it gains its later definition that we recognize today as a person of great intelligence or talent by around the first century, by around the time of the Emperor Augustus. And that's because, of course, if you were especially talented, you must be blessed by some personal deity. I just want to suggest, the movie is called The Royal Tenenbaums. It is named after the patriarch, and it labels the entire ensemble, thusly, by the name of their patriarch. Derek, you have a hand up? Do you have a question?
No, I'm stretching my lats from going to the gym this morning.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I didn't ignore you if you were raising your hand. Like,
sorry,
you were in class.
I was having a muscle cramp, so I'm just stretching.
That is so funny. So the entire ensemble is labeled by the name of their patriarch or their pater familias, if you will allow me to use that term, the legal term for the head of a Roman family, and if you'll permit a brief diversion into Roman family law.
I would love this.
Yes, I promise this will all make sense. So the Roman family, or familias, was an economic unit, a legal unit, including all the people who lived under one roof. So the spouse, the children, any adopted children, servants, including enslaved ones. The pater familias had autocratic control over this unit. And he might even have similar control or authority over his extended clan, which was called a gens. Augustus, the emperor I just mentioned, would later adopt this structure into his imperial style, calling himself both princeps, which I think is first citizen. Is that right, Derek?
Correct. It's like first among equals.
Got it. And he also called himself the pater patriae, like the father of fathers, the father of Rome.
And that's where we get like father of the fatherland. That's why Hitler used that language.
Right. So in the family unit, a pater familias was also responsible not just for the legal accounting for this family, but also for priestly duties known as sacra familia. He was not just a father, not just a lord of the house, he was a priest. And attending to this family's household gods and ancestors was part of his duties. The household gods and ancestors would be known as the genius. The genius was said to suffuse all the members of a clan, and the pater familias, as the clan's legal representative, would perform ancestral rites, in turn conferring genius to his descendants and all of the people in his gens, his clan. So, where does royal fit in with such a context?
Can I just interject real quick?
Yeah, please.
Before you do that, if you've ever seen the HBO show Rome, they do a really good job characterizing how this would look in a Roman aristocratic family. And we know this largely because the Mount Vesuvius erupts, a great scene with Owen Wilson and Derek Zoolander talking about Mount Vesuvius.
I've never even been to Mount Vesuvius.
Mount Vesuvius erupts. It covers Pompeii with volcanic ash, a terrible tragedy killing tens of thousands, however, perfectly preserving a Roman city as it was. And in it, you would have these very thin paper masks of your ancestors, and a candle would be put behind it. And then they would be lit. And as you would perform these rites, these faces would seem to glow as you would commune directly with your ancestors. You know, one of the most interesting things, like we think of Roman religion pre-Christianity, and we think of it as, oh, it's just a copy of the Greeks. And that is such a reductive and simplistic way to look at it, because the Romans had their own traditions. And as their republic grew into empire, as it slowly expanded, it was culturally elastic, absorbing things from peoples and places and absorbing traditions and customs. And if you're an average Roman, whether you're rich or poor, the people you prayed to most were going to be your ancestors. That was the most common form of Roman worship, was this form of ancestor worship. In fact, and this is dated to the Etruscans, a people the Romans absorbed into Romans, it is ancestor worship and that tradition that goes on to form gladiatorial games, which we talk about in our gladiator episode.
Whew, that was amazing. Thank you for that. Also talking about that ancestor worship ritual with the masks and the candles, like I know what we're doing tonight after we record this. Anyway, so back to royal and where he fits in with Roman family law and the pater familias. So Royal Tenenbaum is loudly and brightly proclaimed from the title of the movie, from the first few words of the movie, and from his overall presence in the movie as a patriarch. But he is absent by the time we catch up with the family. He hasn't spoken to any of them in 3 years. He's seen to be manipulative, spiteful, unfaithful, not nurturing. He steals money from Chaz rather than providing for him, a direct inversion of what fathers are supposed to do for their sons. He harshly criticizes Margot's play instead of encouraging her creativity. He bets on Richie's tennis matches and abandons him when he chokes. He is at best an absent pater familias and at worst a destructive presence, a destructive father. And yet, it's his reintroduction into the family, into the broken family unit, that's a catalyst for the individuals to heal and become whole again. His trickster qualities actually bring a sense of liberation to Chaz and his sons and help them overcome the grief and the trauma that they've endured. He's able to counsel Richie and Margot sort of honestly and objectively through their torment. But the family doesn't truly become whole until he legally severs himself from them. He serves Etheline with divorce papers so she can bring Henry Sherman, a nurturing, supportive man, into the legal role of pater familias. He thanks her for raising their children, acknowledging the invisible work that she did over decades when he was off gallivanting around the world and sleeping with other women and getting stabbed by Pagoda, and allows her to bring a gentle, tender, loving man who will nurture the family, even when you think, you know, a father's not needed anymore because the kids are grown. that character, that presence is needed by them because it's been so destroyed by Royal in the past. So I ask, what is Royal Tenenbaum in this context? Is he a patriarch? Is he a trickster? Is he a deadbeat? Is he a bastard? Is he a paterfamilias? Or is he the genius in the ancient Roman sense of the family and of the house on Archer Avenue? Is he the spirit that suffuses this family and that can be called upon as an ancestor by the new paterfamilias, by Etheline, and by his children and his grandchildren, so they can remember his spirit and what he brought that was good, and also move on and be whole and healed people?
Beautiful.
Thanks.
I love that. I love that so very much. I thought that's a really great point. I love that you got into the nitty gritty of the Roman household and related that through the term genius and related that to this movie. I think it's interesting that Margot is very uncomfortable with that term. And I do think in 2023 America online discourse, people are very cavalier and very easy to, you know, give that label of genius. And it's interesting to think of the genesis of it and that Royal's real role, his memory, his spirit, is there to guide this family in their times of trial and strife. And it is, in a weird way, it is Royal's actions in this movie, though he goes, like, he's such an interesting arc because he goes from pure selfishness to selflessness in it. And it is his arc of selfishness to selflessness that, I won't say true selflessness, because he realizes he is actually happier when he is with his family. You know, so there is some selfish motivation still in him, but it is that action that allows this family to start to heal, because in a way, you can't have this family without him because he is the patriarch. Like, he is a part of this family, and the tragedy of the character is he learns very late in life that putting effort into his family is worth it. It is very rewarding, and they need it, you need it, everyone needs it. Everyone needs the family to put effort into it. But the beauty of this movie is that it wasn't too late.
Yeah, I love it. I want to close out just by asking you a quick question. Who is the character in this movie that you most relate to?
You know, that's a funny thing to say. When I first saw this movie, I really kind of identified probably most with Eli.
I knew you were going to say that.
You know, like, way too full of myself, into taking drugs, you know, probably wasn't as cool as I thought I was, and really liked hanging around people that were really cool and talented, and more cool and more talented than me. And I was probably really more related to that. Now that I am a dad, rewatching this movie, it reoriented my entire perception of it, and I really identified with Chaz. And Chaz, the first time I saw, first few times, I've seen this movie maybe 3 or 4 times, I was like, Chaz sucks.
Yeah.
Guy's a dweeb. My goodness, let your kids have fun. Now that I'm a dad watching that, I'm like, oh, this man cannot deal with the fact that he's a single father. He cannot deal with the fact that the world has risk. He can't deal with the fact that his children almost died and will do absolutely anything to keep them safe. He's a man that can't confront his own grief and his own trauma. And I'm like, he's a man that's successful in business, which I aspire to be. I'm not a Chaz. I'm not a business genius, you know, but I aspire to be. And so I really identified with Chaz. My dad and I, which we don't have anything like Royal and Chaz, but my dad and I sometimes can be pretty stubborn and with each other and butt heads and still argue. Like, I never fight with my mom, but if I'm in an argument with a parent, it's probably my father. It's usually over something stupid. My dad and I will agree with 99%. We'll find the 1%. And then we will battle to the death over this 1% and over things that don't matter that we can't control, like who the best fifth starter is for the Phillies. And like, we will argue that for hours sometimes, even though we agree on everything else. And so I really did identify with Chaz as a sad man who wants to keep his sons from harm. And I'm like, that hit home. And then it is Chaz that's there with Royal when he dies. It's Chaz's healing and forgiveness that I think symbolizes the healing and forgiveness the whole family has. And it is Royal's love for his grandkids, which first really makes, I feel, is like the first major step to him truly wanting to be with his family. So this time around, I'm on Team Chaz.
I had a similar journey with Chaz because as a kid, when I watched this, I was like, eh, no, get to the like juicy stuff with Richie and Margot and like get to Royal, like get to these more interesting characters. But now watching it later as a parent and as an adult, I can so clearly see his grief and see his pain and see how much he has at stake. And I do think other than maybe Royal, he has the widest arc. He has the most to overcome. And he does, and that is really, truly moving by the time he does it. When he looks at his dad and he's petting the new dog and he's like, I've had a rough year, Dad. Like, you and I were both bawling watching it. So I had a similar journey with Chaz. I really appreciate that.
You know, we're pretty much out of time. There's an entire Freudian read to this movie that we didn't even get to.
Oh, yeah, we didn't even talk about the, like, incest. Adopted siblings in love. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this movie's about incest.
Yeah, pretty much. She was adopted when she was two, their brother and sister.
The whole thing is this whole Oedipal complex, which is something that can be mapped very easily to Greek mythology. Why? Because Freud wrote about Greek mythology.
Yeah, Oedipus is from Greek mythology. Yeah,
but so we didn't get to that part, and we've been talking for a while, and it's late. I've been up since 4:30 in the morning, and I just don't have room to talk about Freud and sex and incest right now.
You know what? I think that's fair. For a Friday night, you can take a Friday night off talking about that.
Freud and incest and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
This was a ton of fun. Up next is Life Aquatic. We're going to do that one
next.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Did I get that right?
Yeah, we're doing Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou next. If you have a favorite Wes Anderson movie, tweet us. Let us know why. If you have a least favorite one, let us know why. We'd love to hear from you what you think of him. And we've got, I think, three of these planned. So
if you guys want us
with more.
Yeah, to talk about more, yeah, hit us up on social media. We'll keep doing it because watching Royal Tenenbaum was just like, yes, I love this. And until next time.